It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Milton Veterinary Practice. Traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440, MillertonVet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, founder, co-owner at the Milton Veterinary Practice. It's Our Lady of the Questions, and here she is.
Thank you. I am ready for questions. This is a beautiful day, so my brain is on fire.
Okay. And this one even had, like, as with Jeopardy, this one even had a visual clue, but you've got that, presumably. It was from Kit in Peekskill. I saw this photo on BuzzFeed of an official-looking sign that warns pet owners how much hotter asphalt is than air temperature. According to the sign, if it's 77 degrees Fahrenheit outside, the asphalt is 125 degrees. And it claims that at 125 degrees, skin destruction can begin in just 60 seconds. If it's 87 degrees, the asphalt is 143. I don't know why this sign would exist if it weren't true, but then I don't get how dogs can even walk across the street in normal summer temperatures. I'm sending in a screenshot of the sign. Hope you get it.
Well, you know, the point is here, the point that's driven home here is that you have to be careful about that asphalt in the hot sun. I think that we've all walked across, well, certainly I have as a kid, you know, walked across hot asphalt or hot cement around a swimming pool, things like that. And it depends, of course, on the amount of sunshine there is, not necessarily the temperature, I think, and the shade of the asphalt. When it's really black, it's absorbing all that heat. Yes. So the point, though, is that to be careful with your dogs, and especially if we're having a, you know, especially warm temperatures and it's a sunny day and the sidewalk is, or the, you know, asphalt is in the sun for hours, then yeah, it can burn blisters on their feet. So a good rule of thumb is when it is like that out is to walk early and to walk late when things have cooled off. You'd have to be careful because, in fact, I have seen blisters from heat and, dogs have pretty a good number of layers of skin, especially on the bottoms of the pads. But the heat damage can cause some really painful blisters.
I have four different things to say. I
don't know. Four. You have a list. Go for it.
I have blisters on my fingers. That's thing one. Thing two, as a kid, that is where we first learned to say and dance around, going uchi ouchie uchi ouchie uchi ouchie. Was when the concrete or whatever was
right, and sometimes the sand at the beach.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's that dance that you probably learned in a comic book, but that actually takes place. I think that you are absolutely right. This is actually a comment. Looking at the sign, the point that is being made is what's correct. I think look at the ground, feel it. But just because it's 77 out does not mean that the asphalt is automatically the temperature given. And I think that is Kit's interpretation.
Right. So it's maybe 77 degrees, but the sun has been shining on black asphalt for, you know, and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and right. It could be pretty hot.
But it's also, you know, the sun does. Anyone who goes outside, you know, and doesn't live in a virtual world does know that the sun moves and there are different places of shade along the way. So it's manageable. And as an ex-city person, the only thing that I am going to add is having burnt my dog's feet before, but mostly because I gave a super, super long walk. I've told this story before. You know, not that I walked him over hot coals like a swami, but just because we kept
persistently
going.
Hot feet.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was like 20 blocks. That was way too much for the young lad at that time. So it's a certain amount of common sense is.
Yes. I mean, even at the beach, you know, I've been to the beach and I can't walk on the sand without flip-flops. And so people love to bring their dogs to the beach. And I'm all about leave the dog home. If you want to come to the beach later in the day with your dog and it's cooler and there's not very many people and they can run across the sand and go and down by the water, great. But, you know, they shouldn't be drinking that salt water. and they shouldn't be walking on that hot sand.
And they shouldn't be eating that sea scum.
Even with a tent, they're lying there panting all day.
Right. No, and it's just so funny because when you put the veterinary, it's like wearing an African queen kind of hat with a veil. You know, when you put the veterinarian filter on and you look through it, there is no reason whatsoever, you know, to take your dog to the beach except to run him or her first thing in the morning and then go home. But not as a, here, let me pack my cooler, let me pack my umbrella, let me pack my dog because he's going to have a great day out here. He, she's going to have a great day out here in the hot sun.
Yeah, it's not a great day. It's not a great day for ours anyway.
But again, the veterinarian filter is a very special one, and we are grateful that you have it, and you're probably sad that the rest of us don't.
Doug, well, my family always thinks that I'm a fun sucker for having that filter, but probably other people do too.
But that we used to call it a buzzkill. But the problem is that you know what's it's almost like watching something in slow motion that you know that you're going to have to get up and deal with. Like when let's say wine glass decides to jump off the tray, and there's a certain slow motion thing that occurs. So I think it's just an awareness that possibly it's less about being a buzzkill and more about knowing the consequences that there's a really good chance that the person who's doing it is not aware of.
Right.
Blissfully unaware. And it's not like you can tap them on the shoulder and say,
Not these days. No, you have to be very careful who
that's
you
right.
tap on the shoulder
that's
and give
right.
advice to.
That's why I said you can't do it. So you have to sit and then just, you know what's going to happen. But, Doug and Stephanie in Coxsackie. If that's the way to say it. Bon Bon, our house rabbit, had, if this is the way to say it, Pastorella last month. The rabbit has recovered, but one of our kids is immunocompromised, and I'm concerned that if it happens again, she could make him sick to the point where we're considering whether we have to rehome Bon Bon. If a rabbit gets Pastorella, is it likely to get it again?
Rabbits can have a real problem with Pastorella. I am not a rabbit expert whatsoever, but I have treated them for several years. I have seen the abscesses that Pastorella, it's Pastorella multocida, and I've seen the abscesses that are produced, and they are cottage cheesy under the skin. The rabbits don't do well. They lose weight. They don't eat well. They can have gooey eyes and ears and respiratory disease called snuffles. And you can treat it. It is treatable. But they don't seem to ever get rid of it 100%. And Pastorella, the bacterium is ubiquitous. It's just that animals who are stressed have problems with infection, right? So that maybe the immune system's not so great. Maybe the food's not so great. Maybe the husbandry, the caging is not great, and maybe there are other animals in the house, some sort of stressors that make them more susceptible. And so they very often will get it again. This is true. So I would have to say that it is potentially zoonotic. I do know that as a veterinarian. I think that it has to enter through, cuts in the skin type of thing, but I think that would be they definitely can get it again. I know that's the only question I'm being asked, and that should be discussed, of course, with the pediatrician.
Okay.
As far as what to do about that. But it can be devastating. But it's possible to have a conversation with a rabbit veterinarian, someone who treats them all the time, and talk about housing and other things that you can do to reduce stress. That may be part of the issue.
All right. Is it an exotic? Is there a name for that sort of veterinarian, or is it?
Yes, exotics. I didn't mean to say a rabbit veterinarian.
No, but no.
It's exotics.
Okay.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
But that could include any. Do ferrets come under exotics?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So basically, not a dog and a cat and a horse.
Yeah, pocket pets and birds and
pets.
All those little critters, chinchillas.
Oh.
That probably, some of which should not be pets, but
right, okay.
But bunnies make really good pet very often.
Okay. No, and that's true. And I just recently saw a bunny and a cat who clearly were siblings, so to speak, and they had lived mm-hmm. together. They were living together in the video, imperfect harmony, but they were quite familiar with each other and each other's idiosyncrasies. And you had to look twice to realize that it wasn't two of the same.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, they can get along really well with cats and dogs,
yeah.
And they make a good they can make a good house pet. They can be litter trained and live in the house, and but Pastorella, I don't know. You know, I'm not an expert, so I don't really know. Is it susceptibility that runs in certain lines of rabbits? I'm not sure.
Right.
I do know the struggle with treating it.
All right.
You have to be super careful with what kind of antibiotics you give to rabbits, because you can kill off all the good bacteria in their gut and kill them with particular antibiotics like penicillin. So this is definitely something that should be talked about with an exotics animal specialist.
Right. No, it definitely sounds looks so simple, sounds a little more complex.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Hanifa in Bristol, is there anything that can be done to alleviate nausea in a cat undergoing chemotherapy? Especially interested in natural remedies. Thank you.
There are lots of drugs, that are used with really good success. Natural remedies, I think that most people usually are thinking about the cannabinoids. And I know that there have been some studies with cannabidiol, cannabinoids in general that are not psychoactive. In my hands, I don't know whether it would be, I don't know whether we know about what to give and what dose to give. Definitely, if your kitty's having chemotherapy, that would be something to discuss with your oncologist. I hope that the oncologist would be up on those types of things. There are also, there are also many wonderful anti-emetic or anti-vomiting nausea drugs on the market as well. Sometimes I use slippery elm in upset stomach in general, but really hard to get into a cat. And there is a veterinary oncologist who is also trained in alternative medicine. Her name is Erin Benink, and she has a website with wonderful things. She also does integrative oncology, and she does consultations. So Erin, E-R-I-N, and it's B-A-N-N-I-N-K. She's in California, but if you can find her, Google her, and she is the guru of integrative oncology and veterinary medicine. And, a consultation with her would be probably a great thing to find out what things you can be doing while the chemotherapy is knocking down your pet. What can you be doing to build them up? In conjunction with this question about nausea.
Right. No, I think that's
so things like acupuncture. I know acupuncture can be helpful. It's just that, do you have a cat who would be okay with acupuncture? There are Chinese herbs, there are Western herbs, vitamin D testing and supplementation, and all kinds of dietary interventions.
This is assuming that the cat will be not just look at you going, yeah. And?
Cats are hard. Cats are much harder than dogs, right?
No.
You have to say, I can do all this. What I tell people is, I can do all this, but can you get that into your kitty?
Right.
Yeah.
And
without stressing them out too
exactly.
much.
Exactly. And without stressing yourself out too much, because that transmutes. And what I think is really interesting is how cats will set the tone. They'll let you know. They'll absolutely let you know, because it's more like eliciting cooperation than dog. You can
yes.
a dog
yes.
you can kind of fake out maybe more than once even, but a cat
yeah.
is.
I mean, there are some cats out there, and I think they're the ones who've been given supplements and so forth their whole lives. Who I'm amazed at what people can get into them.
Right.
A few, but it's the person and the relationship with their kitty, and they know their cat whether they can get these medications in or not, in liquid form, pill form, should they be flavored, what flavor they like, all of that. So those are great questions. But when you deal with, Dr. Banning deals with cancer patients all the time, and so I would refer to her for, you know, for using alternatives other than acupuncture.
Right. And the great thing about someone who does X, whatever it is, all the time, is they've got a whole frame of reference working that we wouldn't. We wouldn't have because
absolutely.
They can
yeah.
mix and match.
And she might say, you know, you're using chemotherapy, nothing's going to work, but this Serenia and ondansetron together, or
right.
there's a drug called olanzapine. So, and if you're talking about short term, maybe that's the way to go to keep your kitty eating and taking all these supplements I want her to have. So,
right.
So I hope that was helpful.
It was. All right, John in Saugerties. I overheard my vet talk to a lady whose dog had eaten a granola bar with raisins and chocolate in it. He told her that he'd seen hundreds of dogs that had eaten raisins, and so far he'd never seen one have a bad reaction. I thought raisins were super toxic to dogs. He also said something about chocolate being not dose-dependent, or maybe it was that chocolate was dose-dependent. I had to leave at that point, but it made me curious, what's the deal with chocolate?
Chocolate is definitely dose-dependent, so it depends on how much chocolate that you give. That they've ingested, and it depends on how dark the chocolate is. So that's definitely, there are calculators that help with that, with the percentage of chocolate and the poundage of your dog and how much you think they ate. So it's really important when you call poison control, which is what should be done, is that you have some idea of the range of amount of food that may be contaminated. So you know, that's where we have the most trouble when people call us. They don't really know. They haven't stopped to think about it. How many chocolate bars were out on the table? How many are back in the package in the cupboard? How much could they have eaten? That kind of thing. And it's important to know, and it's important to get help right away. The sooner you get help, the better. Raisins can be toxic. The problem is raisins and grapes, we don't really know. We don't really know how many are toxic and why some animals are more susceptible to that toxicity. So it's hard to say, oh, your dog just ate one grape, don't worry about it. It's very hard to say that. So we always have people call the Animal Poison Control Hotline because they have all the most up-to-date information and they have the calculators and they are there to do that. So for us to be able to have to stop what we're doing, 12 other things that we're doing and help you immediately is almost impossible. So Poison Control Hotline is the place to be. They sometimes get very busy. I think there are a couple of animal poison control hotlines. But to get on the phone right away, talk with a veterinarian there. They ask you all these questions, and they give you a plan, and they give you a case number. And then we can get in touch with them regarding the case number and carry out whatever it is that needs to be done, such as inducing vomiting.
Right.
Sometimes they'll tell you, I think, that depending on the toxicity, they'll tell you how to induce vomiting, how much hydrogen peroxide to give.
All right. So before we get too far into that, since John was eavesdropping, okay, I'm curious. Is there an amount of chocolate, when I say an amount, so let's say that there's a Hershey's Kiss and your Labrador eats it.
A milk chocolate Hershey's Kiss.
It's
not going to hurt a Labrador.
Right. So let's say that your teacup something, your little 3-pound whatchamacallit, eats a piece of dark chocolate.
Yeah, so that's where I would be concerned. If your teacup eats one chocolate chip, you know, it's milk chocolate, probably not a problem either, except potentially with
diarrhea or something.
Vomiting or diarrhea or maybe poor appetite or, you know, they can have some really severe diarrhea if they're eating milk chocolate with a lot of fat in it. Not to say that milk chocolate can't be toxic. It's totally dose dependent.
Right. Right.
So you have to look at your package and say, this is, you know, what percent of chocolate. They give all that information, and if it's not on the package, you call the company.
Right. And I'm just, for one quick second, because, you know, we have all had the experience of walking into the room and looking at the smiling pet, you know, with their, you know, what they've just done. And before you go absolutely, you know, incandescent with anger or fear, it's good to do a quick environmental assessment so that you can sort of figure out what you're dealing with, and then hop on the phone. Like, obviously, no time to be lost. If you've got a situation, hop on the phone with not even hop, run, don't walk to the phone with poison control.
So, and I had a situation where someone at a party at my house was feeding my dog grapes, asking him to sit and throwing him grapes. And thank goodness my children know all about that. And so I had to bring him outside. I immediately made him vomit. Every single grape came up, and then I didn't have to worry about it.
Did you invite the person back?
Pardon?
Did you invite the person back?
Well, yes, of course. The person didn't know a thing about it, so it was not their fault. And they felt very, very, very bad about it.
And so we're going back to actually, am I a buzzkill or not? Well, we'll put that down on the, along with the hot sand. All right.
Okay.
I think we've got time for one more question. I am not positive. Helen in New York City, recently my little 30-pound blue heeler chihuahua mix Lottie was viciously attacked by a German shepherd. Afterwards, I examined Lottie thoroughly, or so I thought. A full week later, I found a puncture wound on her hip. I felt so bad. I don't understand why there was no blood. Can you explain? Also, there was swelling around the puncture that didn't go down for almost 10 days. Vet said to just watch it, and it did go down on its own, but she didn't explain what it was. P.S. This is not a question, but I'm hoping you will please tell everyone on the air how to break up a dog fight. Luckily, I knew to yank up the shepherd's hind legs, but its owner had no clue what to do, and I can't bear to think about what would have happened to Lottie if I had been equally clueless. That doesn't seem like a one-minute question.
Okay, oh my goodness. So I think that I have to say first that if you yank up the hind legs of a German shepherd who's in a dogfight, you're taking your life in your hands, or certainly your face and your arms, and not just a shepherd, but any big dog who is in a dogfight. Their first instinct is to turn around and bite you. And so that's pretty scary. You know, the old idea about water and the hose, if it's convenient, but most of the time it isn't, you know, is a great thing if you can pour water on them. You can also make a very loud, distracting noise if you've got anything to do that. If you've got a whistle, it's always a good idea, I think, to train your dog to come to you with a whistle, and then you've got it around your neck and you can blow the heck out of it. You need something to disrupt the activity so that you can grab your dog. But you have to be careful of that, because if that big dog comes back, you know, you're going to be right in the middle of it. So the best thing to do is not to let your little dogs off a leash, I guess, unless you are pretty sure nobody's around. I know that's hard to do. We should be able to let our dogs off leash.
And it's also, then they're the ones where you take every precaution known to man, and then the universe nails you. So
absolutely, I know. My dog was attacked by a big dog, too, at a ball game. And the man was standing on the leash. The dog was barking at the end of the leash, and he still didn't do anything. And then he just turned, and he let the dog go. And he came. I had to use my most severe mother voice. I stood between them and I yelled at him to sit, and he backed off. But he was going to kill my dog for sure.
Yeah.
So it's those kinds of things that you can't avoid. You've got your dog on leash. Somebody else you see has their dog on leash, but doesn't matter. So I completely understand. It's a really difficult situation.
All right, so having talked about that and having run out of time, what we are going to do on our next show is revisit this question, because it is clearly worth talking about, and stuff happens, stuff happens, and that's not the word I would normally use, but we're on the radio. So thank you very much, Dr. Cannon.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Good questions today.
This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.